This continues, lest it come to scandal, the genesis of Jewish kingship, from Lot and his daughters to Judah and Tamar and the Book of Ruth. This is the fourth tape in the series. All right. So last week we began to talk about the story of Yehuda and Tamar. How many of you, by the way, were not here last week? Fair amount of you. So I guess I'll briefly review, but you're going to have to hold on to your hats because it's going to be a very brief review. We were looking at chapter 38 primarily in the book of Genesis, but we were looking at also in the broader context of the story in which it appears. And we said that to look at this story carefully, we have to ask not just to understand 38 on its own terms, but also to understand this chapter, the chapter that details the story of Yehuda and Tamar, in the context of the book in which it appears. And the primary question which I had left to you to think about over the past week was, how is it that chapter 38, the story of Yehuda and Tamar, relates to the epic story of the tale of Yosef and his brothers and the sibling rivalry that allows Yosef to be sold down to Egypt and later to rise to power in Egypt? How is this story connected to it? The entire second half of the book of Genesis is a story that is about Joseph. Joseph is the main character. Everything that happens revolves around Joseph and his brothers in one way or another, except for one chapter. There's one chapter in which Joseph is not mentioned at all. Joseph is not even a thought in this chapter. The chapter is not about him. There is a sideline character who is relatively marginal in the rest of the text. He appears again later on in the very end of the Joseph story, in Vayigash, and that is Judah. And Judah all of a sudden becomes the main focus of the story, and all of a sudden Judah's life and the intimate deep details of Judah's life becomes the focus of the narrative. Now, why is that? I mean, presumably every one of the brothers had their own lives. Lots of interesting things happened in every brother's life. Why is it that all of a sudden, is it because these were particularly scandalous happenings, so the Torah couldn't bear to not relate them to us? I mean, why is it that we need to hear about chapter 38, the story of Yehuda and Tamar? Why is it important? And even more than why is it important, what does it have to do with the rest of its surrounding context? What does it have anything to do with the story of the sale of Joseph? So that is the primary question which we've been looking at in this chapter. So we began to read through chapter 37 last week, and we got up to the sale of Joseph. We talked about Judah's failure of leadership, well, actually failure of moral leadership in the story. But we were asking why it was that the story of Judah and Tamar enters into the scene exactly where it does. Immediately after Joseph is sold, we take this digression into the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Why is this digression made? Where is it coming from? So last week we talked about the story of the sale of Yosef in particular. We mentioned a couple points which bear upon the story of Yehuda and Tamar, as we will see. Just to briefly recap what we saw in that story, we saw that there was an evolving plan for how Joseph would be disposed of. The plan goes through three stages. Stage one, the initial plan of the brothers, is immediately when they see Joseph approaching them, and they're very angry at Yosef, and they feel victimized by him and by the father's attitude towards them. Plan A is, let's get rid of Yosef, let's kill him, and let's throw his body in a pit, and we'll go to dad and we'll say, Chaya ra'a achalasu, we'll say that a terrible beast devoured him. That is plan A. Plan A goes by the wayside when Reuven has a modification to the plan. Reuven says to the brothers, okay, let's kill him, but why should we kill him physically with our own hands? Why don't we just throw him in the pit alive and let him starve to death? The Torah tells us, though, that Reuven had an ulterior motive for making this plan, that Reuven actually wanted to save Joseph and therefore wanted Joseph thrown in the pit alive so that he can go back that night and go retrieve him. So Joseph thinks he's got a plan. Plan number three is Yehuda. Plan number three is Yehuda says, when Joseph is in the pit, why should we kill our brother and have his blood on our hands? Ma'betza kinaro gatachino v'chisinu et damo. What do we gain out of killing our brother and covering his blood? Instead, l'chuvenim krenu l'yishma'elim. Let's sell him instead to this caravan of Ishmaelites. V'yadenu al tehibo, and let our hand not be upon him. Ki achinu b'sareinu hu, because after all, he is our brother. V'yishmu echav. and the brothers listened to him. Now, what is the difference between Yehuda's plan and Reuven's plan? What we suggested last week is that Reuven is actually, on a moral scale, we might say, more heroic than Yehuda. Nevertheless, he is not as much of a leader as Yehuda. In other words, Reuven does not really stand up to the brothers. Reuven feels, even though he's the oldest, unsure as to whether or not he can really stem the tide of what is this going on. And therefore, instead of confronting the brothers directly, Reuven makes an end run around the brothers. Reuven says, let's kill him, all right, but let's throw him in a pit. And surreptitiously, he plans on extracting Yosef from the pit later on. However, Yehuda actually stands up to the brothers and makes a moral argument to them. Not just a pragmatic argument, but a moral argument. He says, why should we kill our brother and have his blood in our hands? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, because after all, ki achinu b'sarenuhu, after all, he is our flesh. When he says, after all, he is our flesh, that's a moral argument. In other words, we can't do this to our brother. We can't kill our brother. You don't do that to a brother. He is, after all, our brother, as much as we hate him. And therefore, let's sell him instead. As a leader, Yehuda is acting as a leader. However, whether he is acting with moral rectitude is another question. We'll get to that in a moment. What do I mean he's acting as a leader? Rashi comments on the words Vayishmu Echav, that the brothers listened to him, that the brothers not just heard him, but that they understood and accepted what he's saying. And in Hebrew, Vayishmu has that connotation as it does in English. The brothers listened and were persuaded by him. Yehuda persuaded the brothers. The truth is, I think, that that really is the essence of leadership. He's standing up to the brothers and persuading them of his moral convictions, what he thinks is right, and the brothers are accepting it because he has said so and because he has impressed them with his arguments and with his powers of persuasion. That really is the essence of leadership. There's an interesting book, by the way, if you want to read about this, a contemporary book written by a fellow by the name of Richard Neustadt. He's a professor in Harvard University Political Science Department. And he wrote a book, which he continues to update every now and then, called Presidential Power. And he goes through all the presidents from FDR until Clinton, and he analyzes how effective each president was in the exercise of his power. And he has a theory which makes its way through the book, which is, if I would say to you, why is a president powerful, what would you tell me? What makes a president powerful?
The Constitution.
Okay, the Constitution. Okay, so you might say the Constitution makes the president powerful. What are the instruments of the president's power? What are his instruments of power?
The military.
The military. He's the commander-in-chief of the military. So the entire might of the world's mightiest army is at his command. Is that the only thing that's at his command? What else is at his command? What? He has the ability to sign treaties. He is as the chief executive. He has the ability to propose legislation to Congress. He has the Constitution granting him manifold statutory powers as executive-in-chief. However, Richard Neustadt argues that none of those are the president's real source of power. Right. What his real source of power is his ability to persuade. And his ability to persuade is his real power. Neustadt argues that, ironically, when the president exercises his statutory powers, he actually diminishes his power. He doesn't really gain power by exercising his statutory powers. The way he really gains power is by holding his statutory powers in reserve, the powers the Constitution grants him, and using his power of persuasion, having those powers behind him, getting senators on his side, getting congressmen on his side, getting public opinion on his side, and then with all that on his side, having real weight and being able to persuade people to go along with his agenda without really having to lift a finger in terms of actually exercising, calling in the military, or using... I wonder what he'd say about Clinton with Clinton's use of executive orders to be able to get things done through a Republican Congress. It's an interesting fly in the ointment in his theory. But basically he says that the president's statutory powers are not the seat of his power. Holding that power in reserve and the power of persuasion is his power. By the way, a similar argument can be made about other things as well. A friend of mine is a real estate attorney who was before my time at Neri Yisrael in the yeshiva here, rabbinical school. And I was chatting with him over Pesach. He and I were in the same place. And he said that he was very close with the Zohar Shiva Zatzal, Rabbi Weinberg. And when he was in yeshiva, thinking about his future, deciding about different paths to take, whether he should make a path for himself in the world of Jewish scholarship and teaching, or whether he should go into business or law, he had many discussions with Rabbi Weinberg about that. And he ultimately chose to enter the profession of law, and he's done very well. And along the way, he talked to Rabbi Weinberg about it. He says, you know, what we really need is we have a training system for scholars, but we don't have a training system for business lay people, to make responsible leaders in the community. We should have yeshiva for people going into business, for going into law, for people who are going to be able to teach them what it means to be a responsible leader in the community. Because you go out and the yeshiva doesn't necessarily prepare you for that. You think that you write a check and that's what it means to be a leader in the community. You don't have an understanding what communal responsibility really is. You should be a yeshiva for that. But anyway, so he was talking to me about trying to establish some sort of program for that. But then he recounted to me one interesting discussion he had with Rabbi Weinberg. At one point, he went to Rabbi Weinberg to discuss with him the issue of wealth. How is it that you deal with wealth? And the question that he had for him was the following. He says, you know, wealth is a really great burden, and I really don't understand how to deal with it, because, he says, if I was just making a little bit more than I needed to live, if my family needed $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 to live, and I was making $120,000, right? So then I could see putting a little bit away and giving $5,000, $10,000 to charity every year, and that would be how I would live, and everything would be fine. But he said, but I look around me, and I see great communal needs, and I see people that need food for Shabbos, that don't have enough food. I see great need around me. In Israel, I see great poverty. He says, now, if I have $1.5 million in the bank, what justification is there for me to keep that $1.5 million in the bank? How could I not give away 1.45 million of that and just keep what it is that I need for myself? You don't understand that. The Rashivi he recounted said to him, well, the Rambam says, Maimonides says, that hayivazbez al yivazbez yosar mechomesh, that if you're going to be generous in terms of charity, you still shouldn't be generous to the point of giving more than 20% of your total assets. So you have to cap a limit of 20% of your total assets. So he challenged him. He said, I don't understand that. How can you tell me that I have to cap this limit at 20% of my assets when I have all this money in the bank and when I don't need this money? I don't have useful. I can't spend it all responsibly. So why is it that I should be holding on to this? What rationale is there for me not to just give it all away? So Rabbi Weinberg turned to him and says, look, you don't understand who you are. You don't understand your money and you don't understand your wealth. You can't say you don't need the money. You're making a mistake. You think, he says, that the purpose of money is to spend. If the purpose of money was just to spend, then you're right. You don't need any, this money isn't part of you, you don't need any of this money. He says, but that's not what wealth is about. The purpose of wealth, and this sounds strange coming from Rosh Yeshiva, says the purpose of wealth is really to have, not just to spend. You become a more persuasive person in the community, in your ability to do things in the world, because of the wealth that you have. It's not just a function that you could spend it on toys. That's not what it's about. It's because of the position that gives you and the leverage that gives you in life. And you will be able to do great things with that leverage if you're able to use that correctly. And that's what it's for. You can't say, I'm doing nothing with it. You are doing something with it by it just being there. And therefore, you give 20%, but you don't give more than that. A very radical perspective, one might think, on wealth. You would think that just give it all away. Really very, very interesting perspective. But again, it goes to the core of what leadership really is. What does it mean to be a leader? It's not your statutory powers. It's not that you can, it's not you're spending the money. It's not you're spending the capital of using your armed forces. It's not you're cashing in the chips and what you do statutorily in terms of your powers. It is ultimately your power to persuade by virtue of who you are that is your real power. Whether you're the president, whether you're a wealthy person, or whether you're a king, right? Or whether you're a leader in any communal situation. And that is what Yehuda understands, and that is what Yehuda uses effectively. No threats, nothing, but it's simply the power of her persuasion to say, we ought not to do this. So whereas Yehuda succeeds as a leader, though, he, in other words, in an amoral sense, he does fail to an extent in his execution of this leadership. And this is what we said last week, that if you simply take Yehuda's argument to its next extension, and you say, okay, if he is after all your brother and you ought not be killing him, then let's bring that to its logical conclusion. What are you doing instead? Selling him into slavery? You don't sell your brother into slavery either, right? There is a short circuit in Yehuda's argument. It ends too soon. And that is a great flaw in Yehuda. It's not a flaw in his ability to lead as leader, but it's a flaw in his moral execution of that leadership. He should have brought that argument through to its conclusion. As Rashi says later on, Vayishmu Achav implies that the brothers were listening to him. He had the power of persuasion. He could have persuaded them further. He could have used this power. He didn't do it, and that is a grave flaw in what Yehuda did. We mentioned last week that there were two sort of additional flaws that occurred here as well that are significant. One is, when the brothers first planned to get rid of Yosef, they planned to kill him and to tell their father that a terrible beast had destroyed him. In the end, they do something much different. It's craftier in a way. What they do is they present him with a bloody coat and say, "This is what we found. Do you recognize the coat?" In doing so, they really put the burden on the father. The father is the one who comes to the conclusion that they want him to come to. And in a certain way, it's a cruel trick of fate because the father digs his own grave. The father is the one who comes to this false conclusion himself and says the words which they had been planning to place in his mouth, Chayara a'achalasu, a terrible beast has killed him. Indeed, the words which the father uses to describe the fate of Yosef is a quote from what the brothers didn't say to him, but had planned to say to him. It's exactly the same words, almost as if to say that the brothers were putting those words in his mouth, that they sought in a certain way, if you could argue, they were rationalizing in their own minds, perhaps, that what we're doing is not so terrible because we're not lying, right? We're not saying anything wrong. We're just preventing a bloody coat. Who, lie? Me? I'm not lying, right? But on the other hand, what they're doing is worse than really lying. Because if they had said it, so then they would have said it. But to put it in the to deceive the father and to put it in his shoes and make him be the one to say it and come to this false conclusion is worse from the perspective of Jacob. There's one other thing which they do, which is a terrible miscalculation, which is this, we ended last week, and that was, what they do is after Yaakov comes to this conclusion, and he feels terrible, and he's misabel, he's in mourning, so the brothers and sisters come to comfort him. And the sense is that they believe that it's possible to comfort this man, and to help him get over it. They probably had rationalized that they could help him get over it. In fact, though, they can't help him get over it. There is no getting over this. And we said before that when Yaakov says, Ki ered al bani aval sheola, that I will go down to my grave mourning this loss, that's not just hyperbole, it's really true. And Rashi says it's really true because Rashi tells us, the words of the Medrash is that the way we get over great pain and deprivation in our lives is through the gift of forgetfulness. We forget the pain and severity of something. Slowly, as the popular adage says, time heals all wounds. But there's one wound that time will never heal, and that is a wound that is still open, that is unfinished. It is only something that is finished that I can let go and time will heal it. But when there is still an open question, time will not heal that wound. And therefore, in this case, what Yaakov understands somehow on a subconscious level, even though he doesn't consciously realize it, is that he can never get over this wound. Why can he never get over this wound? Because Yosef is not really dead. Because it is only when a person is really dead that it's over and that I can forget. But if you're mourning for someone who's not really dead, it's impossible to ever forget. Soldiers who are missing in action, right? Parents who have soldiers missing in action is worse in a way than having a soldier killed in action, because you mourn forever, because it's never closed. Right? And that's the words people always say, I'm seeking closure. If you seek, why do you seek closure? Because once you seek closure, you can move on in your life, and you really can begin the slow process of, quote, forgetting. But as long as it's an open book, as long as there's more to be done, as long as I can make one more trip with a guide back to Vietnam, as long as I don't have the fingerprint or the body part from the World Trade Center, my mind can play tricks with me, and it's not a closed book, and I can never really forget. I can never close the book, and the mourning is perpetual. And so therefore, ironically, the brothers might have thought they were doing something better because Yosef didn't really die, he's safely somewhere else, and we're just removing the nuisance. But in fact, they have frozen this moment of anguish in time for Yaakov, and something which he'll never be able to get over. And when they realize that, they're very upset, and this is the beginning of the story of Yehuda and Tamar. And this is where we got up to last week. Yes?
On a sort of spiritual mechanics level, wouldn't it have been impossible for them to say that he had been killed? Because they were, I mean, after all, these are the shifts they cut. How could they have said something that wasn't in fact the end?
Okay, perhaps they could have, perhaps they couldn't have. The truth is they were contemplating it. That was the original plan. The original plan was the Amarnu Chayara Ala Achalasu. That was the plan. We are going to say that he killed him. They were certainly contemplating telling a lie. Whether they could have told a lie or not told a lie, I don't know. Even if you're right that they couldn't have said falsehood, it just puts them in a pickle. But it doesn't really remove culpability for what it is that they've done. It just means that they didn't have that option. From a moral standpoint, it's not really much better to put the words in his mouth, because in a certain way, that's a crueler fate than simply lying to him.
Did Yaakov do that when he went into Yitzhak dressed as Esav, and he allowed Yitzhak to make the conclusion that he was Esav?
Yeah, that's true. And the possibility exists in a certain way that this might be retribution for that, right? Because Yaakov also deceived someone about their identity. And notice also that he deceived him with the same implements. Right? How did with a goat and with a coat, right? It's the goat and coat connection, right? So the goat and the coat, which were used in the deception by which Yaakov deceived his own father, now come back to haunt Yaakov in a deception in which he himself is deceived. So that is certainly a possibility. Another thing which is similar is that if you look back in the original goat and coat story, which is the Yaakov and Esav with deception of Yitzchak, you will find that the key word of the deception is when Yitzchak does not recognize him, it says velo hiki ruhu, that Yitzchak did not recognize him. You will find that the language of deception here is that the brothers put forth the coat and they say what words? They say hakerna. Would you please recognize this? Can you recognize this? So what they're doing is they're using the very words which the narrator used for Yaakov's own deception of his father, asking Yaakov once again to recognize something, but this time he is the victim of the deception. So the possibility exists there's a bit of a tit for tat for that. Yaakov actually undergoes two deceptions in his lifetime. This is one of them. There's another deceptive act which he also is involved in, which is the marriage, right? Which is the marriage of when he ends up marrying Leah when he thinks he's going to marry Rachel. If you listen to Lavan's words, the father of the brides, right? If you listen to Lavan's words, when Yaakov confronts him in the morning and says, "What have you done? How could you possibly have done this to give me Leah when I was expecting to marry Rachel? I worked for her for 7 years. How could you do this?" So Lavan has a very pat answer for him. His pat answer is what? Lo ye'osa kein bimkomenu laseis es hatzeira lifnei habachira. We don't do it that way in the place where we live here to give the younger one before the firstborn. Now, what does he mean? First of all, younger and firstborn are not opposites. He should have said lateta tzeira lifnei hagdola or something like that to give the younger before the older. Younger and firstborn are not, firstborn and secondborn would be opposites. He specifically doesn't use the opposite of younger, and specifically adopts the word firstborn as a thorn in his side. Really, what is he saying? We don't do it where we come from. We don't do it that way to give the younger before the firstborn. What's he reminding him of, right? Maybe where you come, the younger one gets to be the firstborn. Where we come from, younger ones come first, right? So Yaakov has two deceptions in his lifetime, both of which bear the hallmarks of a deception which he did with his own father. So that's an interesting issue to raise. But anyway, so coming back to the story of Yehuda and Tamar, the question that we need to ask is, what is it about the story of Yehuda and Tamar that connects chapter 38 to the surrounding chapters 37 and 39? So you've had a whole week to think about that. And the question I have for you is, what did you find? Looking through chapter 38, did you find any elements of chapter 38 which reminded you at all of elements of chapter either 39 or 37? Yes?
How about the coat?
Ah, so we have another coat, okay? Judah gives as an Eravon, as collateral in this story, his coat, right? But why does he give that as collateral? Remember, just for those of you who weren't here, just to trace back the story, just remember we're on the same page. We've got the basic story of Yehuda and Tamar works like this. Yehuda goes down from amongst his brothers. He then gets married to a woman, has three children, Er, Onan, and Shelah. So he takes a wife for Er, a woman by the name of Tamar. Er dies, leaving Tamar childless. At that point, the concept of Yibum kicks in, the concept of Levirate marriage. It's a concept elaborated later in the Torah. When a man dies and the couple is childless, the idea is that it's a mitzvah for the brother of the deceased to marry the widow, and the child that comes from that union is seen as perpetuating the line of the deceased. Not just perpetuating the line, but he literally steps into the shoes of his deceased brother's marriage. It's not even a new marriage, it's the same marriage. He's resuscitating the old marriage. He doesn't even have to give her a new ring for Kiddushin. It's simply stepping into the shoes of his brother. It is ultimate surrogate fatherhood. He is just reliving his brother's relationship, and the child is not really his child, it's the brother's child. It's a great act of loyalty that he would do for his brothers. So Onan, the second child, is now asked to step into the shoes of Er and to marry Tamar in an act of Yibum to give, that's what Yehuda says, Yabemota, I want you to marry her through Yibum, and you will have a child, and this child will be able to carry on the line of Er. Onan doesn't do it because he's not crazy about the idea of surrogate fatherhood. Vayeda Onan kilolo yehazera. Onan knows that it's not going to be his child, and therefore he destroys his seed rather than impregnate her. And that's seen as a particularly vicious act, because rather than have a child that wouldn't be his, he destroys the seed that would have had the child. So it's an act of, if I'm not going to have you have a child, then there's going to be no child at all. And God thinks that that is not very impressive, so he does away with Onan too. So Er dies. The Torah, by the way, tells us why Er dies, interestingly. It says, "Vayhi Er ra b'inei Hashem." Er was bad in the eyes of God. It struck me yesterday that Er is ra spelled backwards. Right? Ayin Reish is ra spelled backwards. So Vayhi Er, and Er was, next word, ra, bad, in the eyes of God. Right? So we got rid of Er. By the way, the names of these people are very interesting. Right? Because Er actually means something. What does Er mean? Air, the word ayin resh. Was anyone know Hebrew? What does it mean? Air. What? Come on, folks. Wake up. Air means wake up or to be awake. Okay? Very strange name for somebody, air. Right? Then we have Onan, which is another very strange name. What does Onan mean? Somebody in grief, in terrible grief, is a person in Onan. So Onan means grief. So we have awake, child number one, grief, child number two, and then we have child number three, Shela. Not sure what that means. Right, Shela could either mean Shela, hers, or it can mean Shela, from Shal, to remove, or to be lost, or to be bereft. But with some very strange names going on here. Anyway, so Onan, now Er dies, Onan dies, two children down, one to go. Right, so Yehuda gets nervous, he says, I'm not going to let Shela marry her, to try to get this going, but Tamar wants to marry Shela. Little does Yehuda know that it's not Tamar's fault. So what happens? Yehuda puts Tamar off, and says, you know, let's just wait a little while. I'll talk about it when Shela grows up. And when Shela grows up, I'll give her to you. Well, Tamar patiently waits. And she waits and waits until Shela finally grows up. And she sees that Shela doesn't get the nod from his father. And therefore, Tamar ultimately committed to Yibum to having someone from this family marry her so to carry on the line of the child, decides that if it's not going to be any one of the brothers, the only other chance she had is Yehuda himself. So she sets about to seduce Yehuda, and she dresses up as a harlot and seduces him. And we are told these very strange details of this story, details which really we would think we have no right to know. We're told about the most intimate details of this bargain, of a bargaining section, haggling over the price of this act. I mean, why does the Torah, which is supposed to have no superfluous words, needs to tell us the bargaining session between Yehuda and this supposed harlot? That she says, so what are you going to pay me? Right? And he says, I don't know, what would you like? And she says, well, how about a goat? He says, I don't have any goats. So she says, all right, how about a coat, a staff, a signet ring, just give me some collateral. And so she says, all right, so he gives the collateral, they go, she becomes pregnant, and Yehuda goes back. And then the time comes for Yehuda to retrieve his stuff that he left with her. So he finds this goat, so he's sending the goat. And but the problem is that the messenger who's trying to find this harlot can't find any harlot, and whoever he asks says there was no harlot here, because of course there was no harlot there, right? She wasn't a harlot. So he reports back to Yehuda, and this also, like, why do we need to know this? That he sent the messenger, didn't send the messenger couldn't find him, messenger reports back to Yehuda, and then the messenger says, I couldn't find him, what should I do? Yehuda says, well, you know, you shouldn't keep on searching for the harlot, people are going to start asking questions, what's Yehuda, the big judge, looking for this harlot for? Why don't you just let her keep it, you know, let her keep the stuff already, and then, you know, I tried to find her, I couldn't find her. All right, meanwhile, Tamar is pregnant, and she starts showing her pregnancy. And we said that Tamar was seen at the time as having a committed adultery, because a woman that still had the residual bonds of this marriage still there, even though halachically it's not adultery, but at that time it was considered adultery. So adultery is a capital crime. Yehuda is the judge at the time, sees that Tamar has committed adultery because she's pregnant, and condemns her to death, right? Now Tamar is in a great position of power, right? Because if she wants to, she can spill the beans. And she's got the proof. She's got his stuff, right? But she doesn't do it. Instead, what she does in a great act of heroism is she sends the stuff to him, relinquishing her power, actually, and says, "Le'ish asher ela lo anochi hara." He mutzeit. She is being sent out. And as she's being sent out, she sends back these things to him and says, "The man who owns these things is the father of my child. Hakerna, do you recognize these things or not?" And he then recognizes them and says, "Yes, it's mine, right? And you are more righteous than I." And he allows her to live, never again is intimate with her. She has two children, twins, Peretz and Zerach, one of which becomes the founder of the Davidic dynasty, Peretz. So if this story wouldn't have happened, we wouldn't have had King David. So this is chapter 38. So now, going back to its connections to 37 and 39, I tipped my hand as I was telling you the story because I emphasized a couple of them, right? Is what reminds you of chapter 37 and 39? Okay, so we have deception, okay? An act of deception here as well. Someone is disguising identity. Yosef's identity, or what happened to Yosef at least, is deceived and disguised. Here, Tamar disguises herself as well. Whereas the perpetrator of deception number one is Judah, the victim of deception number two is Judah. The perpetrator is Tamar. So Yehuda is the perpetrator of the first act of deception, becomes the victim of the second. And here the chain continues. Yaakov perpetrated the first deception upon his own father and becomes the victim of the second deception at the hands of Yehuda. Yehuda then becomes a victim of deception at the hands of Tamar. So we have a sort of chain of deception. Not only do we have a chain of deception, but the chain of goats and coats have now continued as well. Because lo and behold, in this story we have both goats and coats. We've got a coat, which is the collateral. We've also got a goat. What was the goat? The goat was what he was supposed to give. Now, let me ask you a question. Why do you think he didn't have a goat? Remember, she says, "What should we give?" She says, "I don't know." She says, "Well, how about a goat?" He says, "Don't have a goat." She says, "Well, if you don't have a goat, how about your coat?" So, as collateral, right? So it's like a Dick and James story. Don't even rhyme. That's right. Okay, so now, why do you think it is that he had no goat? Because it's dead. Why is it dead? Because they killed it in the last story, right? What happened to the goat in the last story? He has lots of goat, but the goat is dead, as it were. In other words, the goat has been slaughtered, and its blood has been used for his cloak, right? So guess why he doesn't have a goat anymore? The goat is dead, so he has no goat. He has to find a goat replacement. So the goat replacement is his coat. Okay? All right. So we begin to see this chain of deception involving goats and coats, which is very interesting. All right. So what else connects chapter 38 to 37 and 39? Yes?
The brothers present the coat to the father, and she presents the cloak. But she's showing the emet, the truth, and
Okay, very good.
They are deceiving him by presenting.
Okay, good. There is a presentation of a coat in both stories. And there's a similarity between the presentation of the coat. Because remember, if Tamar had wanted to, she could have wrapped everything up all by her lonesome self. She didn't have to send that goat to Judah and let Judah draw his own conclusions. She could have forced the conclusion upon him and everyone else by calling the inquirer, right, and showing the stuff that Judah has and says, "I am being unjustly killed here." She doesn't need to do this, right? So instead of imposing her will and her identification of what this coat really is upon the person who matters, what does she do? She lets Yehuda dig his own grave if he wants to. If Yehuda is going to lie about this, then he's going to have to come forward and he's going to have this in his hand and he's going to have to not recognize it. He's going to have to say no. So interestingly, the same way that Yehuda and the brothers presented a coat to their father, really putting it on their father and saying, "Dad, you decide," Tamar does exactly the same thing. She presents a coat to Yehuda and says, "Dad, not dad, but Yehuda, father-in-law." Actually, it is dad. It's his father-in-law. So she says, "Father-in-law, you decide. Now, not only that, but there's a fascinating connection between those two presentations as well, which is, listen to Tamar's language. When Tamar presents that coat, she uses two key words. She says, Hakerna, do you recognize this coat? What is she quoting? She's quoting Judah himself. Okay? When Judah presented that coat to their father, the first coat to the father, what did Judah and the brothers say? They say, Zos matzanu, this we have found. And then those fateful words, Hakerna, could you recognize, please, this coat? Okay? In all of Tanakh, the words Hakerna, actually Hakerna, Haker Lecha is used, but the only two Hakernas, I believe, are these two Hakernas in Tanakh. So you have Hakerna 1, recognize, please, the coat, what Judah says to the father, and Tamar now uses exactly the same words, presenting the coat to Yehuda. So we have that connection, which can't have been coincidental. By the way, that connection runs a little bit deeper as well, which is that not only is there a Hakerna, but there's also, the beginning of the sentence is Zot Matsanu, right? What did the brothers say to the father? What did the brothers say to Jacob when they find the bloody coat? They say, Zot Matsanu, we have found this. Hakerna, do you recognize it? I want you to look at what Tamar says to Yehuda and see if you can find anything that sounds like Zot Matsanu at all, right before she says Hakerna.
The word mutzeit?
Yes. He mutzeit. Okay? It actually can be the same shoresh, the same verb. He mutzeit. Now, what does mutzeit mean there? In that context, it really could mean two things. Mutzeit could be from matzah, which means to find, as in zot matzanu, we have found this. As it happens, though, the word he mutzeit, as it is used there, means not she was found, but she was being taken out to be killed. He mutzeit, as she was taken out to be killed, she presented the coat and said hakerna. However, it's interesting that it's the same word, it just means something else. Instead of meaning that we found this, recognize it, she was being taken out, recognize it, but the word matzah is the same word, it just has a different meaning in this case. Himutzeit instead of matzah. But what's interesting is that if you look at the surrounding context of what Tamar says, and if you look at the surrounding context of Tamar's words, you will find that the word matzah, find, does appear many, many times. If you look at the verses before this, what happens? Let me read you a couple of these verses. Verse 20, Vayishlach Yehuda Gedia Yizim Biad Re'ehu Adulimi, and Yehuda sent this goat with his friend to bring back the Eravon from the woman, Velo Mitzah, and he couldn't find the harlot. There's the first use of matzah, find. Vayishlach Anshei Mekom Lemor, and then they say, Ayeh HaKdesh Hi Beinayim Al Aderech, where is this harlot? And they said, Loita Bezeh HaKdesh, there's never a harlot here. Vayeshav Yehuda, and they go back to Yehuda, Vayomer Lo Mitzah Tia, I didn't find her. Second word use of the word find. And anyway, nobody around says there's no harlot here. Vayomer Yehuda, then Yehuda says, Tikachla, let her just keep it. Penielavu is lest it come to scandal. Hine shlachti agdiyazeh, I sent this goat, va'ata, and anyway, ata you, lo mitzata, you didn't find her. Third find. Vayhi kim shalosh chadashim, vayugad let him alomer, zanzo tamar kalaseich, and then after 3 months, it was told to Yehuda that said, Tamar has become impregnated illegitimately. Gamine Ahara lose new name, and now she has illegitimate twins. Vayomer Yehuda. Now Yehuda says, Hotsiyuha, let her be taken out, Batisareth and killed. But the word for Hotsiyuha is the same shoresh as matzah, to be found. Okay? And then Himutseit, she was being sent out, same word as matzah, and then she said Hakerna. So it's a fascinating web of words here. What the Torah is doing is it's using the same word matzah, which was used in the first deception. We found this coat, do you recognize it? And using that same formula of matzah, do you recognize it? But interestingly, the Torah has changed its meaning. And it had a long cascade of find, 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 right? 3 verses in a row. But then all of a sudden it takes the same word and changes it to taken out. Which is strange. And now, the next logical question to ask you is there a relationship between the concept to take out and the concept to find? To send off and to find? How are those ideas related? If I take something out to be killed, and I find something, are those two things related? I would say, if you take something out to be killed, are you ever going to find it again? No. The idea of going out, if I have a domain and something is going out for it, right, that idea is actually the opposite of finding something. If I find something, what do? Everyone has a world of things that's in their control and a world of things that's out of their control. If something is lost, it's in the world that's out of my control. I don't know where it is. When I find it, I bring it out of that world that's out of my control and bring it to the world that's in my control. When I send something out to be killed or send something out of my domain, I'm taking something that's in my world of control and sending it out of that world. So fascinatingly, these two things are related. The Torah knows what it's doing here. It's actually taking the word which meant to be found and using it find, and then changing its meaning to mean taken out and using it as a sort of a mirror image of the first zot matzanu. This we found, recognize it. But now, right, now the opposite. Now he's taking her out and he's recognizing it. Now the truth is, what do you make of that? I'll tell you what I make of it. What I make of it is, should I tell you now? No, I'll tell you now. All right, what I make of it is that what was Yehuda looking for? The whole time he was searching. What was he searching for? The harlot, right? But he couldn't find the harlot. But there's an irony there, right? Isn't there? Because where was the harlot all along? Right under his nose. He just didn't know that. So what he thought he couldn't be found was really right there to be found, right under his nose. And what's he really doing when he sends Tamar out to be killed? He's taking away what he had already found and sending it off. In other words, he doesn't know that what he's searching for is already in his domain. And ironically, by sending this woman out to be killed, he is taking away that which he was trying to find the whole time. And that, I think, is what the Torah is saying. He's trying to find her, trying to find her, trying to find her, and then he realizes that she that he was trying to find is pregnant, and he's sending her out, the opposite of trying to find. And then she says, as I'm being sent out, I ask you, but it's the same words as find, the same words which you once told your father, we found this, can you recognize this, right? You are finding me, I'm being sent out, but I'm the one, can you recognize this? So there's something going on here in those connections as well. Again, very deep connection between chapter 38 and 37. Okay, how else are 38 and 37 connected? Or 39 and 38 connected? Yes?
There was the pledge. His pledge.
The pledge. Now, let's go to the Hebrew word for pledge here. The Hebrew word for pledge in this story is eravon. Eravon can mean collateral, right? Something you pledge as collateral. Eravon for Arav, when we say Kol Yisrael Araven Zelaze, we say all of Israel is responsible for one another because a collateral is something that I give you to show that I'm responsible for a loan. So it's collateral. So we have an Eravon in this story. Again, a seemingly extraneous detail in this story. Now, let me ask you this. Is there any Eravon in the broader story of the story of Yosef and his brothers? Do we ever meet a pledge? Do we ever meet collateral again anywhere besides chapter 38? We do meet the words Eravon one other time, okay? And we meet it in the following situation. Yaakov is distressed. He has had Yosef taken away from him. On the first trip to Egypt, Shimon gets imprisoned. The second oldest brother gets imprisoned because the evil grand vizier, who little does he know is actually Yosef, is holding Shimon prisoner to prove whether or not these people are spies. And to prove that they're not spies, they're supposed to validate their story by coming back with their younger brother, Binyamin, which they've left in the land of Canaan. However, does Yaakov feel predisposed to send Binyamin? Absolutely not. What's he worried about? Maybe something will happen to him. I'm not going to lose him too. He says, Yosef einenu. There's no Yosef. Yosef is gone. V'Shimon einenu. And Shimon is gone. And now I'm going to send Binyamin pen yikarei ha'asam. Something will happen to him. I'm not sending him. So enter Reuven. Reuven comes in and says, oh my goodness. Dad, you're crazy. You got to send this guy because the only way we're going to see this man again is if we come back with Binyamin. We can't come back without him. You got to send him. He says, nothing to it. I'm not sending him. So Reuven makes a drastic pledge. Reuven then says, et shnei banai tamit, I'm willing to kill my two sons if I don't return back to Binyamin. I promise you I'll come back to Binyamin. If I don't come back with Binyamin, I'll kill my two sons. Okay? Now, Yaakov is not very impressed with this offer, right? He doesn't need two more grandchildren dead, right? So Yaakov says, I'll pass on that one. No, we're not doing it. And they wait around a little bit longer, okay? And by the way, again, Reuven fails in a test of leadership, because that's not the way a leader, again, if you think about it, that's an illegitimate use of statutory power, right? That's not using your powers of persuasion. It's using your statutory power to the hilt. I power over my children. I'll even kill them if I don't come back. But that's not the way. You can't do that, right? Yehuda actually makes an effective use of leadership one more time. What does Yehuda do? Yehuda says, Dad, Anochi e'ervenu, miyadi tivakshenu. I will be his collateral. Miyadi tivakshenu, I will give myself as a pledge for Benjamin. Miyadi tivakshenu, you can come back to me for Benjamin. What are the consequences if I don't bring you back Benjamin? Nothing. No consequences. I'm not killing anybody, you're not killing me, nothing. But I will tell you one thing. If I don't bring him back, v'chatati lecha kol hayamim, I will have sinned against you all of the days of my life. That is an effective claim, right? That is an effective use of leadership, of persuasion. There's no use of statutory power. It's just persuasion. I'm telling you that my reputation is on the line. I promise this, and I will have sinned against you if I don't bring him back. I am the collateral. And this, Yaakov listens to. It's an effective use of leadership. And it's an eravon. Interestingly enough, what does Yehuda do? Yehuda pledges himself as collateral. There was collateral in another story too. There was collateral in chapter 38 when Tamar demanded collateral. So that's a very interesting thing. We have the collateral here, and we have the collateral later on in the story. So that's another connection between the Yosef story and the Yehuda and Tamar story. Are there any other connections between the Yosef story and the Yehuda and Tamar story?
In 39.
Okay, good. We've got another coat in 39, actually. This will take us a little bit beyond the orbit of where we want to go, so I'm going to just assign this for homework. I'm not going to get into this in detail. But the story in 39 of Yosef and the wife of Potiphar is also parallel to Yehuda and Tamar. We have two stories of seduction, reverse stories, two stories where a woman seeks to seduce a man. But in both stories, a coat plays a prominent role. Because what happens? She says, you need to lie with me. And she grabs him by the coat. What does Yosef do? Yosef slips out of the coat, leaving it in her hands, and runs outdoors in his pajamas, right? Now that is not such a wise thing to do, right? Because you leave the coat in this very angry woman's hands, what happens next, right? She turns it around and says, I've got the evidence, right? Waves it, and she says, he tried to rape me, and let's put him in prison. And they indeed put him in prison, falsely imprisoning him on the basis of this evidence. Now, Yosef probably knew that that was a possibility, but felt that the only way he could maintain his integrity in the situation was to do that. I mean, he had to leave his coat behind, and he was hoping against hope that she wouldn't do that, but it was a possibility that she would do that. Now, if you think about that in terms of the Yehuda story, you find a very fascinating connection, which is what role does the coat play in 39, and what role does the coat play in 38? The coat plays a dual role in each story. The coat starts out as X, but turns into Y. Let's talk about the coat in chapter 38, in the Yehuda and Tamar story. What does the coat start out as for Tamar? It is what?
Collateral.
So it is safekeeping, just something that is held for safekeeping. But the coat turns into something vastly more than safekeeping by the end of the story. What does it turn into? Incriminating evidence. By the end of the story, it is the evidence which Tamar can use to indict Yehuda if she so chooses. Does that remind you anything about the coat in chapter 39? What does the coat in 39 start out being? With Yosef, the second that Yosef slips out of that coat, what is it? It's safekeeping. It was just something that she's holding for him, but she immediately turns it into something else, which is what? Evidence by which she can indict Yosef. So the coat in the hands of the woman in both stories starts as something which is just safekeeping, but by the end of the story ends up as something which becomes incriminating evidence. However, the stories are mirror images of one another, because whereas in the Yehuda and Tamar story, the woman acts with nobility and the man acts out of lust, in the Yosef and Potiphar's wife story, the man acts out of nobility and the woman acts out of lust. And whereas in the first story, the coat will be legitimate incriminating evidence, in the second story, the coat is illegitimate and falsely leading incriminating elements. But there seems to be a clear attempt to portray this as the reverse of that story by the biblical narrator, capital N. So we have connections between 39 and 38, and connections between 38 and 37. Again, one last time, is there anything else similar about 38 and 37? We're just about at the end of our time, so if you don't get it, I'm going to give it to you.
There's a sale of a human. She sells herself to him.
Oh, I didn't think of that. That's interesting. That's interesting. I didn't think of that. But there is a transaction involving something that shouldn't be transacted, something involving the essence of humanity, which ought not be sold. So that's an interesting thing. Very good. I didn't think of that.
Perhaps Yaakov never stops grieving for Yosef and Tamar.
Very good. Isn't it interesting if you think about poor Tamar? Right? What happens? Tamar undergoes a change of clothes in the story. Do you remember what happens when she dresses up as harlot? But she was wearing something else first. What was she wearing? Clothes of mourning. Now think of this for a moment. Isn't this strange? Here you got Tamar. Just do the math. Yehuda had said, you've got to wait until Shelah grows up until you can marry him. She waits until he grows up and sees that Shelah is not being given to her, and then decides to take off her clothes of mourning and to seduce Yehuda wearing the clothes of a harlot. How many years had elapsed in the interim? At least a decade. I mean, more, right? So this woman has been grieving for 10-plus years. She's still wearing black. Why? People don't grieve that long. You grieve for 11 months for your husband. Why is she grieving that long?
In order for what you said about Yaakov to still hold true, she can't have been grieving for her husband, because clearly her husband was dead, so she must have been grieving for something like the ability to have a child.
But that, in a way, is really grieving about her husband. Because remember, what is she after? What she is after, what is her quest for? Her quest is not just for a child for herself. It's to carry on her husband's line. Remember how Yibum works? Yibum resuscitates a marriage that was in limbo. That marriage can be terminated in two ways, through divorce or through death of the husband, with one exception. The exception being, if the man dies when they're childless, the marriage is not completely terminated. It's in limbo, right? So what happens? Marriage in limbo. That marriage can be resuscitated. So what happens? It's unfinished business. In other words, if there was no brother, it's over, right? I can't do anything. If Shelah married him, it's over. We're done, right? But if I'm in limbo, if we can resuscitate this marriage and bring it back, I don't stop grieving. It's unfinished business. And isn't that a fascinating parallel? Yaakov grieves forever because of unfinished business over the death of his child, and Tamar grieves forever over unfinished business over the Yibum, which can continue. So there is that connection as well. Okay, and now let's begin to put it together. So, Rashi, I believe, picked up on this. Rashi was bothered by the questions that we've been bothered with, which is, what is the connection between this chapter, chapter 38, to chapter 37? So Rashi gives an answer which at first glance is not an answer. What Rashi says in chapter 38, the very beginning of chapter 38, Rashi comments upon the words, Vayered Yehuda me'et echav, that Yehuda went down from amongst his brothers. You with me? Now, Rashi comments on that and says, Lama nismacha parsha zu lakan. Rashi asked the great $64,000 question. Why? What is this story doing here? Okay? Why is this story of Yehuda and Tamar here also? V'hifsik v'parshas asher Yosef, interrupting the whole flow of the epic Joseph story. Doesn't make any sense. Okay, now Rashi's going to give an answer, which I think is a very deep answer. But like most deep things, when you don't understand exactly what they're saying, they strike you as very stupid and superficial. So this Rashi is going to strike you as superficial as I read it, okay? But here's what he says. This parsha teaches you, l'lamed, to teach you, shahori, the reason why Yehuda and Tamar is here is to teach you, shahoridu echav migdulaso, that the brothers caused Judah to descend from his position of leadership over them, kishra'u b'tzaras avihim, when they saw the pain and anguish that their father felt upon learning of the demise of Joseph. Amru, they said to Yehuda, ata amarta l'machro, you told us to sell him into slavery, ilu amarta l'hashivo, if you had told us to return him to the father, hayinu shamim lach, we would have listened to you. Now, let's try and explicate the Rashi. As we've discussed, Rashi is actually correct. In other words, when the brothers say that we would have listened to you, it's true. They were listening. Yehuda had the power of persuasion. He could have used it to gone farther. It was a failure of leadership that he didn't. The brothers are right, and they caused him to descend from his position of leadership. How does this explain why the story of Yehuda and Tamar is here? How does this explain Rashi's answer? Rashi doesn't tell you, but there's a couple things that you have to know to pick up on. First of all, if you listen to the verb that Rashi uses the following verb. The reason why the story is here is to teach you Lalamid Shehoriduhu Echav Migdulaso, that the brothers caused him to descend, the verb descend, Horiduhu, from his position of leadership. If you focus on that verb, you'll see where Rashi is coming from. If you look at the verse, you'll see that the first verse, chapter 38, verse 1, in the story of Yehuda and Tamar, tells us, Vayhi ba'eta, he had happened at this time, Vayered Yehuda meit Echav, that Judah went down from amongst his brothers. Rashi is giving a midrashic interpretation of that verse, and saying, going down from amongst your brothers means not just physically going down from amongst them, but it means politically going down from amongst them also. That he descended politically as well. The brothers said, you can no longer be our leader. Connecting it to what? The last verses in the previous chapter. Because what were the last verses of 37 immediately before the story of Yehuda and Tamar? What do we read about? We read about the anguish of the father. Everyone tries to comfort him, but surprise, dad won't be comforted. They hadn't bargained for this. Immediately after that, Vayered Yehuda meit Echav, Judah went down from amongst his brothers. Rashi says politically as well, because having seen what just happened, they said, you can no longer be our leader. Okay. Now, at first glance, Rashi is very nice. It works with the word Vayered. By the way, there's another Vayered, which is a very interesting connection, which Rashi may be alluding to, because the word Vayered appears not just in the beginning of chapter 38. The verb also appears at the very end of 37. If you look at the very end of 37, in connection with the anguish of the father, we have that very same verb. And where is it? It's when the father says, Ki ered al bani avel sheola. I will go down to my grave as a mourner for my whole life. So the father said in the last verses, I will go down to my grave. Judah now says, I'm going down from amongst my brothers. Rashi, based on the Medrash, connects those two going down and said, going down A caused going down B. The father's saying, I'm going down to my grave forever, and that shock caused the brothers to precipitate going down too, to cause Judah to descend from his position of leadership. All very nice. But the problem with Rashi is the following. The problem with Rashi is, if I asked you, did Rashi answer the question or not? Did he sufficiently explain to you why the story of Yehuda and Tamar is here? Has he given you a sufficient explanation? You would have to answer no. At most, all Rashi has explained, apparently, is why the first verse is there, not more. Right? So if Rashi's right, you should have the first verse, and then Judah went down from amongst his brothers, and we don't need the rest of the details. And meanwhile, Joseph went on, right? So why is it that the rest of the story has been there? The argument that I will try to make to you next week, but we don't have time anymore, is that Rashi is actually telling you not just why the first verse is here. He's telling you why the whole story is here. This is what the whole story is about, but we have to figure out why. The whole story is about the theme that Rashi talked about, Yehuda's political right to lead. Does he have it or does he not have it? That is what this story is about. It begins with them causing him to descend from amongst his brothers, but everything in this story is about Yehuda's right to lead and deals with that political descent from amongst his brothers. A linguistic hint to it is the beginning of chapter 39. Can someone read for me for a moment chapter 39, verse 1, the first verse in 39? The Yosef Hurad Mitzrayma. And Joseph was taken down to Egypt. What do you have? Another taken down. As if to connect 39 to that whole story too. That it's not just the end of 37 who has taken down. It's not just the beginning of 38, but it's the beginning of 39 that when we resume from our digression, we again go down to that theme of going down. It wasn't just Yehuda that went down, but in a different way Yosef went down. So the transition into 38 comes through going down. The transition out of 38 comes from going down. And all of 38 had to do with going down. And the question is, how is that really so? So when we come back next week, we're going to get into the story, try to tie up all these loose ends, and talk about exactly how 38 is connected to 39, and why it really is the story of Judah's political right to lead. So I'll see you next week.
Thank you.
This is the end of tape 4. The series continues at this point on the tape 5.